The family of a Boeing whistleblower who took his own life last year has filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the American aerospace giant. The complaint alleges that John Barnett was subject to a campaign of harassment, abuse and humiliation after raising concerns about safety issues. He was found dead before he was due to give evidence against Boeing. The company has not commented on the lawsuit. The Swedish government is allocating $30 million this year to enhance school safety following the country's worst mass shooting at an education centre last month. The funds will go towards specialised locking systems, surveillance equipment and related measures. An oxygen has been found in the most distant galaxy ever discovered, providing evidence that the universe developed faster after the Big Bang than previously thought. Light from the galaxy took more than 13 billion years to reach Earth, meaning it can reveal what the universe was like when it was just 300 million years old. It had been believed the universe at that age was still too young to contain heavy elements such as oxygen. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past month, we have heard from doctors and healthcare professionals who say that so many diseases in this country could be prevented through a healthy diet and lifestyle changes. If you tuned in yesterday, you heard from three people who drastically improved their health and overall well-being by embracing a whole foods plant-based diet. They were dealing with heart disease, liver disease, and inflammation. According to the CDC, 60% of people in the U.S. have at least one chronic disease, and about 40 have two chronic diseases or more. Chronic diseases are the leading driver of illness, disability, and death in the U.S. And unfortunately, the problem is only growing. Cancer rates in this country are also growing, especially among young people. So many people change their diets and lifestyle about finding information from organizations like Forks Over Knives and the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Today, we are happy to be joined by Dr. Neil Barnard, founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Dr. Neil Barnard is a leading advocate in the world of plant-based nutrition and preventive medicine. He's adjunct professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine. He has led a number of studies investigating the effects of diet on diabetes, hormonal symptoms, and chronic pain, including a groundbreaking study of dietary interventions in type 2 diabetes funded by the National Institutes of Health. And that paved the way for viewing type 2 diabetes as a potentially reversible condition for many patients. Dr. Neil Barnard has authored more than 100 scientific publications and 20 books for medical and lay readers. His latest book is The Power Foods Diet. He's also editor-in-chief of the Nutrition Guide for Clinicians, a textbook that has been made available to all U.S. medical students. Hi, Dr. Barnard. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us again.
Well, it's great to be with you today.
Well, it's great to have you, Dr. Barnard. You know, we started doing these shows after I sadly lost my dad to small cell prostate cancer in early January. And we have had such an amazing response because people are, almost everyone is either dealing with something personally or they have a loved one who is dealing with something. And before we talk about your background, I wonder what your thoughts are about where we are today. There's so much scientific research about health and nutrition, and yet, chronic disease is rising and cancer rates are growing, especially among young people. So how are you thinking about these issues?
I think it's fair to say that we have plenty of information now in the scientific community. We never have enough. We always have questions that we want answered, but we have more than enough information to take action. The problem, I think, is that those bits of information are not being made available to people who can use them. For example, we have known for a long period of time that processed meats like bacon and sausage are linked to colorectal cancer. And yet, if you look at the cancer rates among young people, and by young, I mean anybody up to age 50, those colorectal cancer rates are rising. And it's because bacon is a fad. You know, we have bacon-flavored soap nowadays, and you don't hear messages to young people that bacon is something that's as bad for you as anything else that's related to cancer. In the same ways you want to crush a pack of cigarettes and not make it part of your life, people should be avoiding these foods as well. We don't hear that message very strongly. So it's not that scientists don't have the information. I think it's not being put into the hands of people who need it.
At the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, you all do a lot of advocacy work, and you know how money plays into all of this, the influence of money in politics. Can you talk about how that has changed over the years and connect that to the discussion we're having today?
One of the things that really troubled me, many years ago, Breast Cancer Awareness Month got started. Every October, everyone wears pink. And I was on a big television show in New York City, and the topic came up. And I was struck by the fact that they were talking about breast cancer, and it was all about finding your cancer with mammograms. And I asked the producer after the program, I said, why was there no information about preventing cancer or doing what you could to reduce the risk of breast cancer? She said, well, that wasn't in the materials that we were prepped to discuss. And so I looked at the, she showed me the press release and all the press pack. And I noticed that it was the product of the American Cancer Society in partnership with ICI. And ICI is Imperial Chemical Industries. Imperial Chemical Industries makes drugs that are used in breast cancer treatment. And I'm not alleging anything in particular about their motivation, but I found myself thinking that they have no financial interest in preventing cancer. They have a great financial interest in treating cancer. And so the more you find it on mammograms and the more you treat it, the more money they make, but the more you prevent it, the less money they make. Now, I don't mean to say that people in these companies wouldn't give their right arm to cure cancer. What I am saying, though, is that we need to get this information on prevention front and center and to push these commercial interests aside. So that's why we started a different campaign called Let's Beat Breast Cancer. And the whole point is to empower women and men too with information that they can use to reduce the risk of breast cancer, what a plant-based diet can do, what avoiding alcohol can do, and what exercise can do, and these things.
This is so important, Dr. Barnard, because I'm noticing that the increased rates in cancer are getting a lot of attention in mainstream television, all on the morning shows. But to your point, they're spending a little bit of time on prevention, but a lot of it is about the new drugs like immunotherapy. And my dad took immunotherapy and sadly it didn't work, but I know that it does work on a lot of people. And that's fantastic. I mean, it is great that more people are actually living after a cancer diagnosis. But after what I went through with my dad, I don't want people to get cancer in the first place. It's a horrible disease. The process of going to the appointment, I mean, the whole thing is just a horrible experience. So why do you think it is that we're not spending more time on prevention in these conversations?
I think for many people, including the medical community, the idea that food could cause cancer is something that just seemed like an alien concept, despite the fact that we've had plenty of time to get used to this. And let me say, I'm so sorry to hear what happened to your father. My father developed prostate cancer as well, and it was not not an easy road for anyone. But back in 1998, Harvard researchers published an amazing study, and what they were looking at it is factors in our lives that are related to prostate cancer. And you sort of had to blink your eyes and think, could this be true? What they had come up with, dairy products. They said that dairy products are associated with prostate cancer. You think, how could this be? It was the Physicians Health Study, large group of physicians, those who had the most milk, including low-fat milk, had much higher rates of prostate cancer. 3 years later, they did a much larger study called the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study, same finding. About 10 or 12 years after that, researchers summarized the findings from many different studies, and the evidence was really quite compelling that dairy products had some role in prostate cancer. So the question then was, why? Because we grew up with the idea that milk is good for you. Well, what we and others have discovered is that milk's job, if I can put it that way, is to help a calf grow. So to make a calf grow fast, when the calf consumes milk, a substance is formed in the blood called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor. And then when the calf is big enough to eat on her own or his own, they don't consume the milk anymore. So that source is gone. If you take IGF-1 and put it in a test tube with cancer cells, they grow like crazy. So researchers then went back at the Harvard studies and they looked at the blood samples they had taken from the men before the study began. And they found that the men who had higher levels of IGF-1 in their blood indeed had a higher risk of prostate cancer many years later. So what we now believe is that the milk that people are drinking because they thought it was good, or it's just part of our culture, or it tastes good, you know, with an Oreo dipped into it or whatever. Nature's idea was that it supports growth, including the growth of cancer cells. And so we now know that in the same way as Mother Nature said, no, weaning means you're never going to be exposed to this after early childhood. That was good advice that we never really listened to. And then in Loma Linda, California, researchers looked at the same thing, but with breast cancer, same relationship. And then in China, in a huge study, more than 500,000 participants, it's called the Kaduri Biobank study. In China, those women who have not westernized and don't drink milk, very low rate of cancer. In those women who westernized and drank even moderate amounts of milk, had a much higher risk of breast cancer. Same in Japan. When Japan westernized between about 1975 and 2000, breast cancer rates doubled. In all of these cases, genetics weren't changing. What was changing was the foods that people were exposed to. And we now have the smoking gun, which is we know what happens when these foods are in your body. Milk is just one example. It's a very graphic example. But there are many, many other things that we know are linked to cancer. And it's an easy thing to say, well, give me some soy milk instead, or almond milk, or, you know, that's going to be a healthier choice.
I think one of the problems, and we've been talking about this on the show, is that there's so much information online now, and a lot of it is misinformation. I wonder what your thoughts are about this, because when you got into this work, we lived in a very different media environment. And now you have people with YouTube shows with millions of followers, and the listener or viewer doesn't know who to believe, because they can come back and say, well, I have this study that shows eating this every day is actually good for you. And then they can watch a video the next day saying, no, it's actually bad for you. What would you say to people who are very confused by this?
That can be challenging, and it's also challenging as the science advances, too. We saw this with soy products. Many people have mistakenly thought that soy would increase cancer risk when it actually reduces cancer risk. But you can sort of understand how that happened. It was a couple of decades ago that researchers discovered that soybeans have what are called isoflavones. Their technical names are genistein and daidzine and glycine, but they will attach to estrogen receptors on the cells of your body. So that freaked researchers out. They thought, good heavens, we already know that the estradiol in a woman's body attaches to those receptors. And the more of that you have in your body, the higher your risk of breast cancer. True. So when soy isoflavones were found to attach to the same receptors, everyone assumed they must cause cancer. Except as the years went by, the research studies showed the opposite, that those women consuming the most soybeans, whether it was soy or miso or tempeh or tofu or soy milk or even a soy-based burger or a soy-based sausage or something like that, the more soy they had, the less risk they had of breast cancer. And so the high soy eaters had about 30% less risk of breast cancer. And then women who had previously been diagnosed with breast cancer, if they ate more soy, they were less likely to die of their cancer. So soy was beneficial. It reduced the risk of getting cancer. It reduced the risk of dying of it. So researchers go back to the lab thinking, wait, how can this be? If the soy is attaching to these receptors, how can it be reducing cancer risk? And of course, the answer came in is that there are two different kinds of receptors. The alpha receptor, the alpha estrogen receptor, you can think of as the gas pedal on cancer. That's where the estradiol attaches, and it's going to increase the risk of cancer. But there is a second receptor called beta, the estrogen receptor beta. That's where the soy isoflavones preferentially attach, and you can think of that as the brake on cancer. I'm being a little bit simplistic, but what we now know is that when a woman has been diagnosed with breast cancer, we encourage her to up her soy intake. Don't avoid it. That advice was a mistake. So somebody's on the internet and they're looking at some publication from 25 years ago that's not up to date, and well-meaning but ill-informed people just got it wrong at that time.
You also have a study on the PCRM website from the Women's Study for the Alleviation of Vasomotor Symptoms. What is vasomotor?
Yeah, vasomotor symptoms.
Vasomotor.
They're hot flashes. Ah. So a woman is 50 years old, and she's running the board of directors meeting, and she's doing her PowerPoint presentation, and suddenly the room becomes 200 degrees, and she's got hot flashes. This is menopausal hot flashes. What we discovered is that although many women have been using hormone replacement therapy as a treatment for hot flashes, and they're very concerned that hormone replacement therapy is associated with certain forms of cancer, they are right to be concerned about that. What we found is that women who would adopt a vegan diet, plant-based diet, also keep oils really low. So even healthy oils, you sort of degrease the whole diet. And she has soybeans every day. You could cut the moderate to severe hot flashes by 88%. Wow. So almost 90%. So that was about as good or better than hormone replacement therapy with no bad side effects. The side effects were good ones. The average person lost weight and they feel better and they're in charge of their health. So it's a natural approach to hot flashes that does not cause cancer. It would do the opposite.
Well, you can find all of this information at pcrm.org. Today, we are continuing our series on chronic disease, cancer, and prevention. And today, we are happy to be joined by Dr. Neil Barnard, adjunct professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine and president and founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, an organization whose mission is to save and improve human and animal lives through plant-based diets and ethical and effective scientific research. Dr. Barnard, are you regularly asked to go on some of the mainstream shows, but on also some of these new YouTube shows that have so many followers? I mean, I think a lot about debate and what is useful in debate. So for example, we could have you debating someone who advocates for a carnivore diet, but what I'm afraid is that people walk away being even more confused than they were before. But because there are so many people out there saying that, you know, grains are bad or beans are bad or what, there's so many weird arguments out there. Are you invited to go on these shows? And what is the experience like?
Well, sure. You know, and my goal is not to debate. My goal, although I'm happy to if that's where we are, but my goal is to come to an understanding of what we know. As time has gone on, we've been able to accumulate really good information about how foods affect our bodies. And there are certain things that we've learned. Take breast cancer as an example, which is such an important and common condition. Yeah. We know that women who increase their vegetable and fruit intake have less risk of developing cancer. If they're on a plant-based diet, and the best diets are vegan diets. So there's lots of vegetables, lots of fruits, lots of beans, lots of whole grains. You take B12 supplement, that's a critically important part of a vegan diet. But when women do these things, they not only are boosting their antioxidants, which are cancer fighters, but it also is the best diet for controlling your weight in an easy way, because overweight tends to drive the risk of postmenopausal breast cancer too. So when we put the diet together, we can get these benefits. And so when we put these up for discussion, I think we can arrive at an understanding that these are the helpful things. And somebody might say, well, I love the carnivore diet, and people can come up with whatever their arguments are about it. But they're pretty hard pressed to suggest that a pork chop is going to prevent cancer, or Velveeta is going to prevent cancer. I mean, those things just don't happen. So the other piece is, I think people are right to have a certain amount of skepticism about these things, because there's all kinds of nonsense out there in the world. And so it is a little bit of an uphill battle to be able to give information to people. However, At the Physicians Committee, we do research studies. We've done them with thousands of people. And what we've found is that when you give people information and people put it to work in their lives, it works. It works for whether we're talking about a short-term issue like weight loss, something a little bit longer term like tackling diabetes, other things like hormonal issues. We mentioned hot flashes or menstrual pain. These are things where foods do make a huge difference. And when people learn that, it's so powerful. When we're speaking of something like cancer, you're talking about life and death. And it is time to stop fooling around with this. We can make decisions for ourselves in our own lives, what risks we want to take and what benefits we want to take advantage of. But if we do nothing else, let's make information available that parents can use for the next generation to not have the risks that the current generation has now. And that's the most important thing. So we've got to get beyond the nonsense to get the straight information out into people's hands.
This is so important, Dr. Barnard, because since we lost our dad in January, he lost two of his friends to breast cancer. And then another friend who came to his remembrance event is getting chemo for breast cancer, and she had to leave early because she was so tired. So I like how you put that. We have to get serious about this. This is from breastcancer.org. Every year, breast cancer accounts for 30% of all new cancer cases in U.S. women. 1 in 8 women in the U.S. will develop invasive breast cancer at some point in their life. I mean, these are huge numbers. 1 in 8 of us?
Yes, but let's look at some of the things that we can do to respond to that. These cancers are common. Now, luckily, most women who develop breast cancer are not going to die of it. Most are going to do well, but many do not do well. And we need to take it seriously. So we already talked about a few things that a woman could do. Let's say she gets this diagnosis. She is understandably very concerned. She wants to take action. We mentioned that soy products help. And frankly, I would choose the organic soy milk, because if it's organic, it cannot be GMO. And give it to your husband, too, because soy is also linked to reducing the risk of prostate cancer. So a woman who's been diagnosed with breast cancer, soy has been shown to be helpful. Weight loss has been shown to be helpful, even if the weight loss is after diagnosis. And the best way to lose weight is not to starve yourself or go on calorie cutting. The best way is a low-fat, healthy, plant-based diet. We use these every day. Two other things I might mention really quickly. Back about 2 decades ago, the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study, WIND, brought in more than 2,000 women. They all had breast cancer, and all they asked them to do was to reduce overall fat intake. How do I do that? Well, animal fat. I can reduce animal fat by picking the bean burrito instead of the meat taco at taco restaurant. Okay, fine. I reduce animal fat. I keep oils low. What they showed is that just by reducing fat, they could significantly reduce the risk of dying of this disease. Around the very same time, there was a separate study called the Women's Healthy Eating and Living Study. They did the opposite. Instead of cutting fat, they increased vegetables and fruits. And the results that came out of that study showed that there's an amazing dissection of the control group in this study. Some of the women increased their vegetables and fruits. Some of them increased their exercise. Some of them did one. Some of them did the other. Some of them didn't do either one. They showed that if you increased your exercise and increased your vegetables and fruits, no other big changes, you could cut your mortality in about half. Wow. So what I suggest is do them all. Let's do all these things. Let's cut the fat intake of our diet, and we're eating healthful foods. Let's boost the vegetables and fruits and find ways to put them in our lives in a way we like. Soy is a good product. A lot of Americans are a little bit new to tofu, and they think, oh, my goodness sakes, or I've never tasted soy milk. Give it a try. And healthful ways for weight control. We put these things together. Set aside alcohol. They're better ways to party. You can dramatically reduce the risk of developing breast cancer and can reduce the risk of dying of it.
Before we go to break, there's so many news articles out now about alcohol consumption and the link between alcohol and cancer. What does the science say?
The science is clear. The old days of putting on our party hat saying a little alcohol is good for the heart or good for the brain, we have had to conclude that the risks far outweigh any benefits. And alcohol increases the risk of breast cancer. It increases the risk of colorectal cancer. It increases the risk of pancreatic cancer, many, many forms of cancer. So I'm sorry to say that although alcohol is a big part of many people's social lives and sort of a way of winding down at the end of the day, alcohol, if people drink at all, it should be modest and intermittent, not your go-to thing every day. And frankly, we're better off not drinking at all. And if that sounds like a tall order, I might remind people, if you think back, how did you feel when you were 11 years old or 12? You didn't, it wasn't at 5 o'clock, you didn't say, ah, I need a drink. No, you had friends, you had fun, you did things, and you wouldn't have felt better if you had enough alcohol. When people reach adulthood, they kind of get into a little bit of a rut where our routine, it doesn't feel right unless we have a drink or something like that. So these are just acquired habits and we can sort of set them aside. So alcohol is something that, by the way, if it's red wine, the benefits of red wine don't come from the alcohol, they come from the grape. So the grape contains isoflavones and other natural chemicals. The names won't be on the test, but they are beneficial. And so you get them from consumption of grapes, grape juice, many other fruits, many other vegetables. So you don't need the wine to get them.
Today, we're joined by Dr. Neil Barnard, adjunct professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine and president and founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Their mission is to save and improve human and animal lives through plant-based diets and ethical and effective scientific research. Dr. Barnard is the author of many books, including his latest, The Power Foods Diet. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are continuing our series on chronic disease, cancer, and prevention by spending the hour with Dr. Neil Barnard, president and founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. If you have a question or a comment about health and nutrition, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a number of emails. One listener writes, I've recently gone plant-based because of perimenopause. Most plant-based doctors say just eat a whole foods diet and you'll lose weight, but that is not working for me. I understand that I need more protein because of my age. I'm 50. I'm a bit confused about what I should eat because there's so much out there. Can you offer any tips?
Okay. First of all, you've made a great change. It's terrific that you've gone to a plant-based diet. If weight loss is your goal, I would do two things. A totally plant-based diet is obviously step one, and that means grains and beans and vegetables and fruits and all the things that they turn into. Avoid the animal products completely. So if you're still having a little bit of fish here and there, Chinook salmon is 52% fat, and every fat gram has 9 calories. So you want to avoid the animal products completely. But the second step is to keep all oily foods low, even the so-called healthy oils. And the reason I say that is, although a gram of carbohydrate has 4 calories in it, a gram of fat has 9 calories in it. So that's true of animal fat and it's true of vegetable fat. So if weight loss is your goal, I would suggest avoid animal products completely, but also keep oils to really scrupulously low. So what does that mean? You can have all the vegetables and fruits and grains and beans you want because they don't have much fat in them. But nuts and seeds, I would keep them low. And I would learn how to cook without vegetable oils. I would use a nonstick pan. It's a lighter taste, but you'll get used to it quite soon. And you'll discover that things get a whole lot better. If you're having perimenopausal symptoms, if you're getting hot flashes, I mentioned this earlier. Three things. Vegan diet. No animal products. Keep oils really, really, really low. That helps with weight loss. It also helps with hot flashes. And step three, a half a cup of cooked mature soybeans every day. You can get them on Amazon or somewhere, cook them up in your Instant Pot or pressure cooker and have about a half a cup of them per day. Treat them like pine nuts, put them on your salad. And in our study, we found that that would reduce moderate to severe hot flashes by 88%.
Well, thank you so much. You can also support your local co-op because I'm sure they have soybeans, especially one that has food in bulk. Thank you for that email. We have another email from a listener who says, my son had ulcerative colitis as a child and in his teens followed a whole food plant-based diet. He now has no symptoms and has needed no medications for over 10 years. That's another amazing story.
Well, it's terrific in two ways. First of all, congratulations. That's really important. For the inflammatory bowel diseases like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, many, many people find that although these diseases come and go and they create all kinds of misery for people and the medications for them are expensive, that when they make a diet change, in many cases, not necessarily all, but many cases, the diet makes an enormous difference. That's thing one. So getting away from animal products, particularly dairy, often makes a big difference. The second thing is that ulcerative colitis over the long run can be linked to other problems like a higher risk of colorectal cancer later on in life. So we want to tackle it with the diet that reduces the risk of those things too. And so getting the animal products out of the diet is good for that reason too.
Alan writes, I just spent a long night at Kaiser. Fortunately, I had a kidney stone and not an appendicitis. I was surprised when given a list of foods to avoid to prevent future stones. They include many foods that I regularly eat: brown rice, tofu, oatmeal, dried apricots, spinach, Swiss chard, and peanut butter. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that this, I presume the kidney stone is gone. That can be a pretty rough experience, and I hope you are doing well. What they're thinking about is that most kidney stones are calcium oxalate stones. And so they looked up a table of foods that contain oxalates. And so you come up with spinach and things like that. But what you discover is that avoiding them doesn't really make much difference unless you're eating massive amounts of these things. Probably not an issue. What seems to help more is avoiding animal protein for whatever reason. Does seem to reduce the risk of kidney issues and stones. I would suggest that you moderate sodium. I know this sounds funny because we think of that as helping blood pressure, but a high sodium intake tends to drive calcium through the kidneys, and you don't want a high calcium flow through your kidneys because it'll link to stones. And then, of course, you want to stay hydrated. You know that already. Drinking plenty of water so that your urine is not concentrated. And hopefully those things will be helpful.
Well, thank you for that email, Alan, and I hope you're doing well. We have a few emails from listeners who are saying, I just don't remember my grandparents talking about these issues, about so much chronic disease and so much cancer. Why have the rates gone up so much? What are the major changes that have happened over a couple generations?
The easy thing to say is that we don't die of other things as much as we used to. Back in 1900, the principal causes of death were infectious diseases like pneumonia and others. And antibiotics really knocked all that out. So by the time we were in the post-World War II period, the causes of death had radically changed. And the infectious diseases were pretty much under control, of course, with some exceptions like COVID and influenzas and things that have reminded us that we're fallible beings. But the other thing is that our diets have changed phenomenally. In 1909, the USDA started tracking what people eat. And in that year, the average American ate, I believe it was 3.8 or 3.9 pounds of cheese per year. Today, your average American eats close to 40 pounds of cheese per year. Well, cheese has hormones in it that came from the cow. Dairy products are linked to breast cancer. Meat intake has gone up because of relative affluence. Increasing grain intake has gone way, way down over time. It's been rebounding a little bit in recent decades, but it's way down from where it used to be. Our grandparents knew about beans. You know, show me a kid now who goes out to the backyard and picks some beans. I mean, that's just not part of life. If you look at places where cancer rates are low, it's places where they have eaten a largely plant-based diet, if not an exclusively plant-based diet. Dairy products were not a big part of it. Japan, when it was at its healthiest, didn't consume dairy at all. And those things have unfortunately changed. The good news is that we can we can go back to the good old days at mealtime with healthy foods.
Gosh, you're reminding me of my grandparents who ate so many beans and they made tortillas from scratch. You know, it's so what's so sad about my situation with my dad, Dr. Barnard, is that my grandfather, my dad's dad, died at 97 and his mom passed at 95 and my dad was only 74. And I think a lot about their diet and how different it was. I mean, there were definitely, what are those, the boxed dinners in my grandparents' freezers?
Right.
But they just didn't eat a lot of food. I mean, I remember at holidays, my grandmother loved baking and making cakes and things, but they just didn't eat a lot. And then my dad, sadly, you know, struggled with weight for many decades and ate fast food and ultra processed food. And so I think a lot about the differences in their diets. And, you know, the other thing that's so hard and it's connected to this, Dr. Barnard, is we can't pinpoint why people, we know that the factors for cancer, but we cannot pinpoint why my dad specifically got small cell prostate cancer. So that, I think, do you think that's one reason why it's hard for people to make drastic change because we can't pinpoint it?
I think people can make changes and the changes don't feel drastic. And the reason I say that is we're doing a very big study now with people who have type 2 diabetes. We have hundreds of people in this study. And they come in and we put them on a totally vegan diet and keep fat very low. And going into it, people think, oh my goodness sakes, that's a big change. Am I going to really do that? But then in the very first week of the study, they discover, well, wait a minute. Okay, I already eat cereal in a bowl, and to make it vegan, I just stop putting cow's milk on, and I put soy milk on or almond milk, fine. Or I make oatmeal, and instead of, you know, bacon on the side, you know, I might have veggie bacon if I want it, or it's not a big deal. Or at dinner, we go to my favorite Italian restaurant, and instead of spaghetti with the ground beef sauce on it, I put the marinara on it, or the spicy arrabbiata sauce, or these are plant-based foods. So the changes are easier than people think. And we also give people support in making these changes. So we get together every week. That's a big thing too. Mm. So the reason that doctors like me have weekly programs where our patients can come for free and get the support they need, or we write books with recipes and things, is that people need a little information, a little bit of support, and then they can get there. It's like quitting smoking. Quitting smoking is tough. But it's not that tough. You know, I mean, you did it and then you're glad. And then you're in a groove and you feel well. So I don't want people to think, oh, it's so difficult. You have to think about it, you have to plan, you have to have your questions answered, but people can do it. People can go on a plant-based diet and every single day I hear from patients who are a little bit angry. They say, why didn't any doctor tell me about this before? I'm losing weight. Just this morning, I was in a group of people were getting off their diabetes medicines, no longer needing their drugs for blood pressure. Now, don't get me wrong. Anybody listening to this program, do not cancel your doctor's appointment and don't throw your medicines away. You know, you may need medical care, but put the power of diet to work with whatever medical care you're getting and see how far you can go, because it can be life-changing.
Right. And obviously it's easy for, not easy, but like yesterday, for example, we had three people on the show who have drastically changed their diets and improved their overall health. One of our guests lost 200 pounds and he reversed his heart disease. Another guest reversed liver disease. Unfortunately for people like my dad, it was really hard because of food addictions. We have an email from Nancy who says, can you please share your thoughts on food and or sugar addiction and your thoughts on Overeaters Anonymous?
Overeaters Anonymous is a good thing. And foods can be addicting, but the good news is it's not just every food. When a person feels like they're stuffing themselves and they're eating more, it's not that they're going to the store and getting a bag of strawberries and overeating strawberries or apples or pineapples or bananas. What they're overeating is either something sugary, like cookies or cakes or pies, typically a sugar fat mixture. People don't want a box of Domino sugar. They're not a sugar addict per se, but we learned a long time ago that the combination of sugar and fat, like the sugary, buttery combination that makes a cookie irresistible. That sugar fat combination stimulates dopamine release in the brain, and people get hooked on that. The other thing that I think is in many ways even more addicting is cheese. And you'd think, how can that be? It smells like old socks. Why would you get hooked on cheese? And partly is that it is a mixture of salt and fat. There's more salt in 2 ounces of cheese than there is in 2 ounces of potato chips. It's salty and it's greasy, and that hooks us to French fries or potato chips, but also to cheese. But the other thing is, cheese is the only food that I'm aware of that actually has opiates in it. The technical term is casomorphins, the protein in cow's milk called casein, Casein, digests in your intestinal tract to release what are called casomorphins, casein-derived morphine-like compounds. They go to the brain, they attach to the very same brain receptor that morphine or Demerol or any other narcotic would attach to. And they're not as strong as an illegal drug, but the strongest of the casomorphins from cheese has about one-tenth the brain binding power compared with pharmacy-grade morphine. It's called morphiseptin. And we feed these things to kids, and kids, get hooked on these things, and they start gaining weight, and then we blame them for not exercising enough. It has nothing to do with that. It has all to do with food choices. So anyway, the point I'm making is it's sugar, it's cheese. So if we break free, totally vegan, you've solved a lot of the problems. And then what people often discover is if they have sweet tastes, like fruit or other things, or even sucrose, but not in that big fatty cookie, that they tend to lose weight anyway, because the sugar itself is actually relatively low in calories. It's the fatty mixtures that greatly increase the calorie content.
Another question about food addiction. What are your thoughts about the influence of GLP-1 drugs on preventing food addiction and facilitating weight loss, and how that would affect existing cancer?
GLP-1s are a huge moneymaker for Novo Nordisk, talking about Wegovy and Ozempic. They do reduce body weight, but there are, and losing body weight, however you get there, does have benefits. So you can show, at least in theory, reductions in the risk of heart disease. And we would assume that if people carry that weight reduction with them for years, they're going to do well. The problem with the GLP-1s is, first of all, most people quit them. If you look at people who were prescribed them today, who's on them a year or 2 years from now, the vast majority quit. That's partly because they're expensive. It's partly because you don't feel right. People have side effects that they just don't like. And we have been finding that if we never even write that prescription, but we help people make the right kinds of diet changes, we can get significant weight loss. All the side effects are good ones. And instead of costing you $15,600 a year, which is the current cost for Wegovy in most programs, about $15,600 a year, your food costs are actually going to go down somewhere between 15 and 20%, because you're not buying meat anymore, you're not buying cheese. You're spending more on vegetables and fruits, but you're not buying the high ticket items, and so people tend to save money. So GLP-1s, yes, you could show that they have benefit. Most people don't do so well with them, and over the long run. And the big issue, let's say you do lose weight, let's say you lose a lot of weight, that weight plateaus off, and then you don't lose anything more. For the rest of your life, you're now taking that drug just to avoid weight regain. So for the next 20, 30, 40 years of your life, you're continuing to inject, because if you stop, you regain that weight. And so our thought is, wait, let's learn how foods can do the same, so you never have to get into that conundrum.
Well, thank you for those questions. Today we're joined by Dr. Neil Barnard, president and founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Their mission is to save and improve human and animal lives through plant-based diets and ethical and effective scientific research. We have so many more emails today. We got one email yesterday that we wanted to get to. A listener writes, "I have a friend who's diabetic. He eats meat before carbs because it helps slow the breakdown of the sugar in the carbs. Do you have any thoughts on this?"
Yeah. 20 years ago, NIH gave us a grant to try to find a better way for treating diabetes, or preventing it for that matter. But we brought in people who had that type 2 diabetes. We put them on a diet that people are going to think, how would you dare do this? It was actually relatively high in carbohydrates. We had a control group that did the old-fashioned things like limiting carbohydrate, limiting portion size to lose weight. The diet we were testing said, eat all you want. No limit on calories, no limit on portions. Have as much carbohydrate as you want. So you can eat bananas and you can eat spaghetti if you want. But what we're going to do is we're going to eliminate animal products and we're going to eliminate added oils. What we found is that the reductions in hemoglobin A1c, which is the measure of blood sugar control, improved three times better with this diet compared to the control diet.
Wow.
Why? We learned that the cause of diabetes is not what people had. The people had thought, well, maybe I'm eating sugar and that's causing diabetes. That is not the cause. Diabetes is caused by the buildup of tiny fat particles, microscopic fat particles inside our muscles and our livers. And I know that when I said that, people think, what are you talking about? I've never heard that before. So let me say this again. Type 2 diabetes is not caused by eating sugar. Type 2 diabetes is caused by the buildup of microscopic fat particles in our liver cells, in our muscle cells, elsewhere in the body. And as these fat particles insinuate their way into your cells, that came from your cheese pizza or fat that came from a chicken wing, the fat particles inside the cells stop insulin from working. So the more the fat builds up, the more insulin resistant that cell is. So now you eat a piece of bread and the blood sugar that comes from it can't get into your cell anymore. And people think, oh, well, I shouldn't eat bread. The bread has nothing to do with it. The fat buildup from the food, from fatty foods, causes that insulin resistance. So what does a vegan diet do? It doesn't have any animal fat in it at all. If I keep oils low, there's not much of any fat. And so the fat starts coming out of the cells. The cells start responding to insulin. And that's why we started to see something we never thought of is people being able to reduce their medicines, sometimes getting off their medicines, sometimes no longer having diabetes. We never thought that was possible, but that's the idea. So I would not eat meat before your carbs. I would take the meat, feed it to your cat because your cat's a carnivore. You are not. What you should be having is grains and beans and vegetables and fruits and all the wonderful foods that they turn into, and give yourself a shot at improving your diabetes in a serious way. See your doctor.
Wow.
Diabetes is not something to play with.
Thank you for that. It was so interesting and really shocking to learn on the Exam Room podcast. This is a podcast of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, that in the Marshall Islands, they have a very high rate of lower limb amputations, primarily due to diabetes. I mean, this is just horrible. Brenda Davis, who's an incredible plant-based dietitian, talked about what happened when she and others went to the Marshall Islands to work with people on embracing a plant-based diet. I want to invite her on a future show, but can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of this?
Yeah, now you should have Brenda Davis on your show because she's a brilliant dietitian and has done wonderful things. There are many cultures, and the Marshall Islands is one, where there have been really terrible transitions over time. People who were on reasonably healthy diets over the millennia, and then in comes spam and Twinkies and things like that. They're just really not healthy for them, and you see this explosion of diabetes. We see this in Native American populations now, where if you were 1500 years ago, if you were in the Southwest US, in what is now Arizona or in northern Mexico, the staples of the diet were corn, beans, squash, which we call the Three Sisters. There was no dairy. People weren't eating fried chicken. There was no lard in the beans because nobody had pigs. But as time has gone on, these unfortunate food habits have come in and caused diabetes to become an epidemic. But it's not too late. If you have this in your family, you can make diet changes now. And in our work with folks in the Native American community and others, my role model is President Jonathan Nez, the immediate past president of the Navajo Nation, who biggest tribe in the United States, was overweight, not in such great health, and he said, "I'm going to change this." And he went on a totally plant-based diet, lost that weight, regained his health. Has become an incredible role model, and not only for Native Americans but for everybody. He's slim and handsome, and helps people to realize that I don't care how many generations people have been hurting your people. We can turn this around now by taking that power in hand.
This is amazing. I just heard about this story the other day, Dr. Barnard, and I definitely want to invite former Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez to talk about this, because you're right. We don't have time to talk about this, but we'll do shows about this in the future. When we look at Alaska Natives, for example, Native Americans, African Americans, Latinos, when you look at the rates of disease, they're much higher in some of those communities. And of course, a lot of it goes back to racism and social injustice. But people in these communities are saying, we've got to make changes here because we're just losing too many people.
Yes. And you know, also there are other factors too. You know, migration has not necessarily helped us. You know, human beings as a species began in, let's presume, Eastern Africa. And we were in a tropical climate where there was fruit on the trees and plenty of things to eat. And then as people got restless and moved up to Europe and over the Bering Strait and ended up in extreme northern latitudes, I mean, you're not going to eat, there's not much broccoli and there's not many apple orchards. And so what is there to eat? It's fatty fish and that sort of thing. So there are hardships that can make it harder to live healthfully. But if we can bring the healthful foods into our diet, it is astounding how the body can recover.
And final thoughts, Dr. Barnard, what else can people do if they just want to make changes? And, you know, some people think for protein, they need to eat meat every night. Or someone just wrote in and said, you know, what about calcium? Where are we supposed to get that? So what are your thoughts about how people can even begin this journey?
Okay, well, calcium, great question. Get it the same place the cow gets it. The cow doesn't make calcium. Calcium is an element in the earth. It gets into the roots of green vegetables, and the cow eats grass, and that's where the calcium comes from. I hope you're not eating grass, but if you're eating broccoli and kale and Brussels sprouts and anything else green, you're getting calcium. You'll get plenty of protein without meat. You don't need meat for protein, but you do need B12, and so a supplement there would be good. How do you start? Take a week. And during that week, just think about vegan foods you might like to eat. Make a list. At the end of the week, you'll have a huge, long list. And then take 3 weeks and eat those foods for 3 weeks. Just give it a test. No animal products at all. Keep oils low. And what you'll discover, at the end of 3 weeks, you'll have lost weight. If you have diabetes, your blood sugar will have improved probably. Give it a try. And if you like it, stick with it. We have an app called the 21-Day Vegan Kickstart. It is free. It's in English, it's in Spanish, it's on your iPhone. Have fun with it. And at our website, pcrm.org, we have lots of resources. My book, The Power Foods Diet, was designed to make food irresistible because, as you've seen, if you have a copy of it, it's got beautiful food photographs. Everything is healthy, but everything is quick and easy and fun, and it makes weight loss something that people really enjoy as opposed to being kind of starvation. It's fun.
Dr. Neil Barnard is president and founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and adjunct professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine. His latest book, like he said, is called The Power Foods Diet. Dr. Barnard, huge thanks to you and your team for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for helping to get this life-saving message out.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.